Good morning. I'd like to introduce our speaker for today, Imo Denke Raul Moncayo. Imo Denke translates as Suchness, Field of Blessings, which was a Dharma name that Sojin Roshi gave him many years ago when he was a lay practitioner, and he was later ordained as a priest, so he's now Reverend Imo Denke. Raul originally comes from Chile, and he's been practicing Zazen for 30 years, and is a practicing psychotherapist as well at Mission Mental Health in San Francisco, where he serves primarily the Latino community, and he also has a private practice. He travels and gives presentations of papers he's been working on regarding the practice of psychotherapy and the synergy or synchronicity between Zen and psychotherapy. He's a father of two young boys who are 20 and 18.
17.
So they're
yesterday, actually.
And let's see. Well,
that's good enough.
If I say any more, then it'll be half for you. So. Thank you.
Okay. Good morning.
Good morning.
Nice to see you all here and have this opportunity to practice together, and because that's the main thing of this talk and of Dharma talks, is to encourage us all to practice and continue practicing. And it is from the practice that these words make or may not make any sense. Today I want to talk about the four foundations of mindfulness, and I thought of focusing more on the last two than the first two, although that may have changed since then. What prompted me to want to talk about this, since you know the factors that we're practicing with are in flux, and they're always changing, and sometimes we're practicing more with one than with another, although all of them are present at the same time. And what prompted me to want to study and investigate this a little bit and study it a little bit to give this talk was the last 5-day sesshin that we did here during a practice period when we had our shiso, Andrea. Taj, and it was a 5-day sesshin that for me was very sleepy. I was very sleepy, so I was trying to practice with sleepy zazen, and sort of practice finding some way to work with sleepiness and to wake up. And at the same time, not create a duality between being awake and being sleepy or being tired. We have a basically what amounts to a monastic schedule, more or less, here at Berkeley Zen Center. And Berkeley Zen Center is kind of the middle way in terms of scheduling, with maybe Dasahara being at over here at one end, and then the number of practice groups that have sprung forth from many disciples from our family that do 1 day a week, 2 day a week kind of practice. But we still have this kind of schedule, and we all kind of practice it together, and it's been transmitted to us, and we're continuing to transmit it to ourselves first, primarily. And then as we successfully transmit it to ourselves, then we can transmit it to other people and pass it on to the next generation. But it's not so easy to, how we practice with this schedule within a lay practice where you have, you go to a job, or you go to school, or you have a family and you have various responsibilities. And these traditionally, in the old Buddhism, the ancient Buddhism, which we in the Mahayana school like to call Hinayana, were seen as sort of competing duties and responsibilities, the duties of a lay person and the duties of a priest, and therefore it was devised that there would be a kind of dual practice, you know, one for the lay people and one for the priest, and so the standards were different. And what they practiced was different too. So the monks practiced zazen and meditation and observe a kind of monastic schedule, and the lay people practiced various the paramitas and practice of giving and generosity and morality, and also took care of the priests, of the monks, while they observed the practice of zazen. So all of that is kind of combined and permutated in what we do here, because we all observe those practices across the line of distinction between monk and layperson. And this is the practice that Suzuki Roshi transmitted to us, and that was his vision for Zen himself, Zen in Japan or Zen in America, which was you know telling his students here that you are neither monks nor lay people. So then what are we? And this what are we is the koan, which we are in the process of realizing and discovering and manifesting, and we don't know exactly what it is. So what we know is what we're practicing. So we have to practice what we don't understand. And there's another side to that statement. I think it was Tozan, I think, said, practice what you don't understand. And I can't remember the other side of it, but it's not so relevant to what I'm talking about, so it doesn't matter. So the schedule can be challenging, although it fits nicely with the Protestant ethic, which is part of American culture, right? Early to bed, early to rise. That's basically it. But it's not so easy to early to bed and early to rise, because, you know, each person is different, and every family situation is different, and the responsibilities that people have are different. You know, some people are morning people and some people are night people, which means you have your most concentration, your most mindfulness in some ways, although that's a kind of limited definition of mindfulness, and energy in the morning or in the evening. So for morning people, it sort of comes natural to, not so natural, but it's easier to get up early than for night people. And you know, I tend to be a morning person, and I've always been. My mother always said of me and my sister, my sister's a night person and I'm a morning person. And my mother would always say, oh, Raul, woke up and he was always smiling, you know, and kind of ready, what is it they say, bushy-tailed, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, right? And my sister really had a hard time getting up, and she wasn't in such a good mood. But then, you know, the family stories are that in the evening, you know, I was falling asleep at the dinner table, you know, my face right into the spaghetti. And also not prone to such a good mood in the evening because you're tired. And so when you're tired, you kind of want to go to sleep, and your responses are not always your best ones. And the reverse is true for my sister. You know, in the evening, she's quite responsive in there and has her energy and concentration and so on. So in a way, those two types sort of fit also. We have a morning schedule, and then we have an afternoon schedule. So we also have the afternoon schedule for people who are not so prone to get up so early, or not morning people, and they have better energy in the afternoon. And it sort of works out, although there is crossover. There's people who come both in the morning and in the afternoon, and there are people who do mostly morning, and there are people who do mostly afternoon. And it's all part of the Mahasangha, the big Sangha. And then we all go in the world and in all in our different fields of work and activity. And that's even the greater Sangha. So it's all Sanghas within Sanghas within Sanghas. You know, this is how we practice. But each Sangha, each circle of practice is the same circle. It's always the Buddha field, it's always Buddha circle, and we're both in the inner circle and one inner circle, and we're outer to another inner circle. So we're both, you know, inside and outside interpenetrate. But it's difficult, you know, when you get up early in the morning and then go to work. Often you get sleepy. And it's sometimes I'm listening to people, you know, sessions where you really have to pay attention. And it's difficult sometimes to stay up. So what I do is take little cat naps. I close the door in my office and take a, you know, I can do that 5 minutes, 10 minutes. And then I'm kind of, my energy is restored and I can keep going. So in Sesshin, this past Sesshin, what I experienced also is that you become very relaxed, and this practice of absorption, of samadhi practice, you know, you get very relaxed, and when you get very relaxed, it's very easy to get sleepy, because, you know, there's not much difference in the brain waves between sleep, and just pure sleep, and zazen. It's very similar. The only thing is that in zazen, your brain is receiving the information from the different muscles that are working, right? Because in zazen, all our posture is working, and our, you know, our legs are working, our feet are working, our hands are working. Everything is working, and that's part of this dynamic working is what tells your brain that you're awake rather than asleep. But otherwise, you know, there's not much difference. And often, you know, Suzuki Roshi talked about practices going for your pillow in the middle of the night. But still, our practice is not to be falling asleep in zazen. And so I wanted to find a way to wake up. And you know, also, what happens in Sesshin is that you have pain, and often the pain wakes you up. So when you have a lot of pain, there's a lot of intensity there, extension and intention, and your intention to practice is also the extension of the muscles. And so that can be painful, but that wakes you up. And when you don't have so much pain anymore, after you practice for many years, the pain eventually does go away in Sesshin. So then you're very relaxed and joyful, but it's easy to get sleepy. So I wanted to find a way to work with that. So I kept, you know, I tried correcting the posture, and that didn't quite work. Because, you know, in the Satipatthana Sutra, they say that, it says that torpor and sloth and torpor, you know, sleepy is not exactly the same as sloth and torpor, because sloth and torpor is sort of maybe a more descriptive of oversleeping. Like if you sleep too much, then you're kind of in a slothful state. But if you're sort of undersleeping or a little sleep deprived, and most Zen students, we tend to be a little bit on the sleep deprived side of things, meaning, and in Sesshin you sleep about 5 or 6 hours. And also because it's sort of a circle, because you work through the sleepiness through the day of Sesshin, so then you wake up. So by the end of the day, you're wide awake, and then you want to go to sleep, but you're wide awake. So you can't fall asleep until 11, and then we get up again at 4. So it works out in a way that you're a little sleep deprived. So that kind of sleepiness is different than sloth and torpor. You know, and there is a practice of right sleep in order for the practice of awakening. The practice of awakening requires right sleep, particularly if you're going to, be in the world in the sense of holding a job or having family responsibilities or study and so on, for which you need to be alert and you can't take the time to take a nap. Because if you are a priest and you don't have those activities during the day, you can take some time to take a nap. There are rest periods and you can take a nap. But if you don't have that leisure time, then having the right sleep is important. So the correcting the posture is one of the ways. The other one is the practice of light, the mindfulness of light. This is the other recommendation in the Satipatthana Sutra. And so this is what I found that actually kept me awake, was the, and I'm talking about that also in terms of mindfulness of non-thinking. Because the and non-thinking, N-O-N, not thinking. And this is sort of, this goes into the third foundation of mindfulness, which is mindfulness of mind. Mindfulness of mind or mindfulness of consciousness. So the four, just to name them, put them out there, is the first one is mindfulness of body, which includes posture and breath, and I'll say more about that. The second one is mindfulness of feelings. And the third one is mindfulness of mind or consciousness. And here's the mindfulness of mental formations and of the mindfulness of the different states of consciousness, both conscious states and unconscious states. And the fourth foundation is mindfulness of, usually it's referred to as mindfulness of mind objects. I don't like that so much, so I like to call it mindfulness of Dharma. Of mindfulness of dharmas, small d dharmas, which is phenomena, as dharma. And this is part of the mindfulness of light, or the practice of giving and receiving light. Giving light to ourselves, transmitting light to ourselves, and receiving light from the source of light and from each other. So mindfulness of mind objects also refers to how you practice with the different factors, like the five hindrances. So sloth and torpor is one of the five hindrances. So we could say sleepiness could be a hindrance, one of the five hindrances. And so each hindrance has a factor of enlightenment that works with it. So this is part of the practice of mindfulness, is how you practice with the hindrances and the factors of enlightenment that interact with them. So this sleepiness was sort of the hindrance that that I practiced with in terms of the what I'm calling the practice of giving and receiving light. which is also the that's the fourth foundation, but it's also related to the third, because it's how we work with the thinking mind. And Dogen, in his Fuken Sasengi, which is his recommendations for the fundamental art of Zazen, where he gives us the instructions on how to practice Zazen, he says he advises us to think not thinking. And then how do you think not thinking? He says non-thinking. So this is how we practice with thinking, which is neither thinking nor trying to repress our thoughts, because that doesn't work either. So this practice of non-thinking, we could also say, is the practice of not seeing. So the practice of not seeing, which is like in the Heart Sutra, which is the Sutra of Wisdom Beyond Wisdom. So this wisdom that's beyond wisdom is a wisdom of non-thinking. Right? It's not knowledge. It's not thinking knowledge. So it's a wisdom of non-thinking, or wisdom beyond thinking. And it also says that it has all these, among all the no's, is no seeing. And it says no seeing until no realm of mind consciousness. Actually, that's what it says. So in Zazen, we're practicing this Prajnaparamita, which is the practice of not seeing. So what is it that we're seeing? And this is sort of goes to the question of mindfulness, of Dharma, of mindfulness of light. What is it that we're seeing? We're not seeing objects, we're staring at this, we're wall gazing. So what is this wall that we're gazing? Is it a wall? And actually, we realize that it's not a wall. I'm going to come back to that. That's the third foundation of mindfulness. Sort of the non-thinking, non-seeing, and what is it? Because thinking also puts you to sleep, puts you to dream. Thinking puts you to dream, and when you're sleepy, you realize that point of where you go from thinking to dreaming, which is what happens when you fall asleep, right? You go from thinking, and then the thoughts transform into dreams. And so these dreams are like our thoughts. That's how we construct the world, is through this thought. And then the thought becomes a dream, and then all of a sudden we're in the middle of a dream, and the dream is the reality that we're in. So when we're actually awake, we're thinking and we're dreaming. We're walking dreamers. It is daydreaming, right? But that's like the ordinary function of thinking. So before I go further on this question of the two last foundations of mindfulness, if I'm going to have time to get there, because I'm not sure, Paul, how are we doing with time?
15 minutes.
We have 15 minutes left. Okay. So the first two are very important for Zazen, because they're the foundation of the foundation. Right? The the mindfulness of the body is the first foundation, and therefore is the foundation of the four foundations. So in Zazen, we take this this posture, which is the foundation of mindfulness. So we keep adjusting our posture. This is part of mindfulness. And we also do this throughout the day. You know, we're always adjusting our body posture in one form or another. In Zazen or in Zazen, we don't uncross our legs. Unless we have to. Because, you know, that not uncrossing your legs is sort of becomes a difficulty. But that's the way we were all trained initially, you know. By Mel, was no matter what happens, don't uncross your legs. And then he sort of became much more understanding of students uncrossing their legs. But initially he was really strict about that, and that's one of the things that I took to heart. No matter what happens, don't uncross your legs during the period of Zazen. Now sometimes you have to uncross them, and if you have to uncross them, you uncross them. That's no big deal. Because sometimes you get stuck in saying, you know, oh, I'm not supposed to, and then what about when it goes on for hours, or when we have ceremonies? So at some point, not uncrossing your legs becomes ridiculous. So, but that point is different for everybody. So, each person has to make that decision for themselves. And then there's the question of the mudra. And the mudra is, it seems like something small, it's very small, right? The mudra is small, but we say we're holding the whole earth in it. So the mudra is sort of a pivotal point of the posture because it's like the thermostat of the posture. And I've noticed, you know, I started doing this this sitting group for clients at the clinic where I work. And I focused on posture. Because, you know, there is this practice of mindfulness where people practice just being mindful of their thoughts and their feelings and, you know, and also breathing. But don't focus on the posture. And so this is sort of the difference between the different schools of Buddhism. But our school of Buddhism, you know, we focus on posture a lot. And posture is something that's not so easy for everybody. So I find that a lot of the clients in the clinic really have a difficult time with the posture. And not many people can sit in the floor and cross their legs. So it's important that we understand that the posture takes different forms. But no matter which form it takes, whether you sit, you know, in the floor, you sit in a chair, whether you sit, you know, in the Burmese position or the half lotus or the full lotus, each posture has the totality of the Buddha Dharma in it. And the mudra is sort of what's continuous and not across all of them. So the mudra is really important. So I noticed that with this group, it was really important to teach people how to hold the mudra. And sort of hold the mudra and keep the back straight. Those are the two basic ingredients. But the mudra is also a way for them to monitor their mental state. So it's interesting, you know, because people are told that they have a chemical dysfunction nowadays, right? Because we're in the era of the brain and brainiatry, as I like to call it, sort of psychiatry. So people are told that people are taking different medications, and they're being told, well, this disorder of your thoughts or your feelings have to do with you know, biochemical disorder and transmission of impulses from neuron to neuron and that kind of thing, right? But in the transmission of neurons, it's either too much, so it's like being flooded by thinking, or not enough. Or being too excited, like in mania, you know, like having too much energy, or not having enough energy, like in depression. So it's that kind of duality. It's either too much or not enough. So it's the middle way. Right? So the mudra is kind of the way of the barometer, of the thermostat of the middle way. It's how to keep the energy in the brain or in the mind just right, at the right tension. Not too much and not too little. So it's become interesting for people to notice their mental state with their two thumbs, you know, they're up like that, then they can see that they're thinking too much and they're getting into sort of very paranoid thinking or anxious thinking or manic thinking or whatever it may be. And the thumbs are up like this, thumbs up. And when they're sort of getting discouraged, and this is not helping, and you know, so on and so forth, then the thumbs go down. So that was, I mean, that's something that we hear all the time, but it was a kind of a discovery for me to see how important just how you hold the hands and the mudra can be. Seems like a minor thing, but it's sort of like the little that holds the great. And then there's the mindfulness of breathing, and which is in the Satipatthana Sutra is the factor that counters anxiety and worry, or the hindrance of anxiety and worry and worry and flurry. So when we're feeling anxious, even though we have mindfulness of mind and consciousness, and the light may be there as well, there's also this feeling of anxiety that arises. So that's the mindfulness of feeling. And the factor that is most effective for dealing with when you're anxious, just like I was saying before, if you're sleepy, is the factor of the awareness of light or mindfulness of non-thinking. For anxiety is breathing and counting the breaths, not just breathing but counting the breaths, because it's the counting that interrupts the usual kind of thinking that leads people to become anxious. So I was a little anxious this morning about giving this talk, you know, so I was really practicing mindfulness of breathing. I was really focusing on breathing and counting my breath. I don't always count my breath. But at critical points, you really count your breaths and focus on breathing, and it's the right practice for that particular dharma or hindrance. And then there's the mindfulness of feeling, which is there already. I was talking about that, but I want to mention another aspect of it, which is what I'm calling the awareness of the semblance. And the awareness of the semblance is sort of how we hold our feelings in our face. And because often, you know, the heart sort of is revealed in the face, and how we hold our feelings in the jaw. So it's important to keep the face open and the jaw relaxed without shutting down the face. Sometimes, you know, a lot of the Buddhist statues, particularly in Japan, the Chinese statues, often the face is kind of more open and relaxed. Or there's a more, that's also an important part of the awareness, because part of the awareness of feelings is the antidote to deal with anger. just like breathing is the antidote to deal with anxiety, awareness of feelings is particularly an antidote for working with anger and angry states of mind. And so the angry states of mind is reflected in the face in this kind of, you know, stern, serious face, you know. Which sometimes, you know, we have a stern, serious face, that's it. That is just that. That's what it is, a stern, serious face. But often it means that you're practicing with anger and you're holding the anger in the jaw. So to open up the face is a way of letting go of the anger and letting go of the tension in the jaw, and then having the intention of having, you know, good wishes the practice of compassion, of offering compassion for all beings, and just going around the world practicing that and letting go of the anger. You can't, you know, the anger will arise, it will be there, it will be triggered by different things, but we don't hold on to it. And often when we're holding on to it, it's reflected in the face. So you have this kind of angry, you know, Zen style, you know, Japanese, you know, you see that sometimes in the face of the statues. It goes into the art. Whereas the Bodhisattva figures, they have a kind of open face. It's more the feminine principle also. This kind of inner gracefulness. This kind of inner gratitude and inner gracefulness as a kind of fundamental predisposition towards the world. And this is part of the awareness of feelings. How are we doing?
3 minutes.
3 minutes. So maybe just say a few things. Didn't get to talk about the mindfulness of non-thinking, this practice of perceiving light. It's the mindfulness of looking at what's right in front of your nose. The nose. And the nose is the only part of the face that we can actually see. So usually in language it's referred to look at what's in front of you. That's part of mindfulness. Pinpoint this one dot, this one thing that's in front of you. But what is this one thing, this one point, this needle that is in front of you? Is it an object? It's not an object. Well, what is it then? And so it's turning the question more on the subject than in the object. What is the subject of the subject? Of the nose. What is the subject of the subject of the nose? And what does nose mean anyway? Nose sounds like no, the nose, Buddha's nose, the nose of the Prajnaparamita, and the nose of wisdom beyond wisdom. So it's the no nose. This nose is not a nose. So in the Bible it says, you know, if your hand bothers you, cut it off, you know. So if the nose bothers you, so we don't say the nose bothers you, cut it off. We say if the nose bothers you, realize that this is not a nose. No nose. That's what the Heart Sutra says. No eyes, no nose, etc., etc. So actually, if you look at the point of your nose, you will see the source of light. Try that sometime in Zazen. If you look at the point of your nose, it's the point where the two eyes meet, and there you find the essence of perception. And the essence of perception is the source of light, is our inner light. We think the light is out there, but actually the light is in here, is the subject of the subject. And this is the thinking, non-thinking. or seeing with the eye of not seeing, or true seeing is no seeing, as Suzuki Roshi said. So this is the same as mindfulness of of mu. This is the koan practice. Each thing is the whole universe, or the light of the universe is in each moment, in each thing. And so this is mindfulness of Dharma, mindfulness of mu. What is it? So we're not just mindful of objects, that's concentration. Right? Each thing is happening in time, and at the same time, there's no time. And this no time of time is mu. So mindful of everyday activity is not just being mindful of all the things that we're doing, is mindful of everything that we're doing. This each thing is this mu, is this light. So that's the fourth. And that's the final. So the first foundation posture and the final one is of Dharma. They come together as the same thing. Thank you very much. And can we have a few minutes for questions?
Yes.
Thank you, Alan. Yes.
So Bodhidharma sat for many years facing the wall, and I guess to deal with his problem of sleepiness, maybe, I guess this is the question, why did he cut off his eyelids?
Despite his face? That's kind of like extreme. So there's a question there. Do you read it literally? It's a myth. Do we read it literally, or do we read it symbolically? If you read it literally, it's Hinayana practice. Because it creates a duality between being awake and being asleep. Being awake and being asleep are not dual. Our teacher is falling asleep all the time. Are we going to say he's not awake? Alan.
Well, it's humorous, but it's also speaks to our condition. Actually, if you don't like your nose in the society, then you get a nose job, which says something about our relationship to our body and our relationship to the realm of desire, rather than what you were pointing at in relation to mind with mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the beauty comes from this light. And that's why, you know, in Zacine, everybody looks so beautiful. Despite whatever, you know, nose or whatever face or body we may have, everybody's beautiful because that's the source of light. So we try to change it at the objective level, right? So have a nicer nose or nicer body or whatever it may be. Instead of, we're looking for new landscapes rather than changing the eyes by which we see. Yes, Richard.
I wanted to go on the other side of the cutting the eyebrows off. And Hinayana, but there is the fable talks about, or the way I interpret it, talks about making an effort to stay awake. So could you say something about that?
Yeah, so that, good, that's a good point. So cutting the eyebrows may be symbolic for the effort that we put in Zazen and in the posture.
Eyebrows are essential to a Zen master, but eyelids.
Yeah. So the eyelids is symbolic for the practice, the fundamental practice of Zazen, and holding the the posture and sitting for long periods of time. And sitting through being tired and sleepy and angry and all those things, all the dharmas that are continuously arising and ceasing to exist. So that's the aesthetic. I mean, there is an aesthetic core to Zazen. And Suzuki Roshi said, aestheticism is more important than monasticism. Because the aestheticism of the posture is the fundamental practice in that sense. So that's what the idealist represents. More than, because what about, you know, his student cutting his arm off? Are we going to, you know, recommend that people cut their little limbs off? That's Zen fundamentalism. It's sort of misapprehending the teaching, and sort of in this kind of fundamentalistic way, which is taking things literally.